So, Rebecca, I have a long list of emails that people have emailed in that I have been trying to get to with you. But every time we get into talking, we just answer like one email. But I have like, I don't know, 30 emails. So I
have an idea.
Okay.
Which is speed round.
Yeah.
Like whenever one of us has the right, whenever we feel like we're trailing off, we just yell speed round. And like we have to drop it and go to the next question.
That's right. So trauma dumping. You wanted to talk. So actually, this is not an email, but you wanted to talk about trauma dumping. You texted me the other day and you're like, trauma dumping. We got to talk about it. So what did you want to talk about?
Well, so I led my vicarious trauma training and someone brought up this video, which I
this
have.
This is for therapists.
For therapists. Yeah. And I had she brought up this video and I haven't been able to track down the source material, but I saw all this other stuff about it. So maybe listeners have seen it where a TikToker who's a therapist did a video where she said she was spoofing a overwhelmed therapist, making fun of her clients for disclosing too much information in the first session. And she said, don't trauma dump. And she got all of this negative feedback and I think had to go off of social media because of all of the...
Wait, so let me get this straight. There's a therapist on TikTok ridiculing clients for talking about their trauma in therapy.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
My God.
Doesn't go well.
Doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. And the video, I can't find the video, but I read everybody else's responses to it.
Yeah.
But it was a new, even the term was new to me, trauma dumping.
Right. I haven't heard about it. I hadn't heard it till a year or two ago.
Which my joke is now formally known as friendship.
A trauma dumping, formerly known as being a good person,
well,
being listening or talking about your feelings with somebody.
And I think what that points to is we're all so stressed out that we don't have room to hear anyone else's traumas. But
yeah.
And
which
you
is really an old thing. You know, I looked a little bit into the discourse around trauma dumping and when it's used and found that it's just an old premise, a patriarchal premise of don't talk about your feelings and shut up little lady about about your feelings, you know, I don't want to hear about it. And it's just rebranded as ridiculing trauma dumping. Now, having said that, it can be legitimately used when someone non-consensually corners you and forces you to hear about things that you don't want to hear about, and you have a hard time establishing boundaries, or the other person is making it hard to establish boundaries, then yeah, trauma dumping, sure. But I find that when trauma dumping is being used, it's sort of like gaslighting. Gaslighting's a real thing, but when I hear it being used, I'm usually skeptical about what the premise is as to why they're using it.
And to anyone who's out there worried that they're telling their therapist too much trauma...
Yeah, God. Which everyone is, or most people are.
Yeah, I believe you can't trauma dump to your therapist. That being said, I will say to people, when I think they feel like they have to tell me every single detail, or I won't believe them, or it won't seem like enough for them to be in therapy, I will say to people, hey, you don't have to tell me the whole story in one session. This isn't a race for content.
Well, and not like today's episode, because this is a race for content, because we're speed rounding. But the premise, from what I understand that you're saying, which I agree with, is that if you feel like a client, and often people will do this in and outside the office, they will feel like they have to give you a lot of details to justify what they're saying. And at a certain point, you feel like, you know, you don't have to continue to make your case. I believe you. Like, if you want to tell me more, great. But don't feel like I'm skeptical about your claim that you were treated poorly. You can just, you had me at hello kind of a thing.
Right.
You know?
Thumbs up.
Yeah.
I believe you.
Yeah. Go ahead and continue if you feel like you need to, but don't feel like you're on your heels trying to defend yourself against some sort of scrutiny that I'm doing. Yeah. So what was the reaction in this vicarious trauma training that you were giving?
It was interesting. I mean, someone brought it up as an example of a clinician that was way more burnt out than they were willing to believe.
Right.
Which became really a theme of the presentation, was people kind of realizing, oh, I'm not doing so great. And so the idea that a clinician would put out a video like this then what's going on with that clinician that they need to make fun of other people disclosing trauma?
Right.
They probably just should have said, I'm at the end of my rope. I'm taking a week off. I'll see you in a week.
Yeah. And my clients deserve to dump as much trauma as they want to in therapy. And I'm suffering. I can't really do it right now. So, yeah. And I don't want to blame it on CBT or bad training or, a troubling trend that I hadn't predicted, which is why would I predict this, is that I'm finding more and more therapists are essentially being supervised by the internet.
Oh.
And the internet is not a good supervisor.
Yeah.
Unless you really seek out competent voices on the internet. But the vast majority of discourse around gaslighting or trauma dumping or narcissistic personality or whatever it is, or love bombing, I hear clinicians starting to use terms from the internet. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no. I mean, it was one thing before when people were ignorant, students right. didn't know anything. It's another mm-hmm. thing when they come to you being brainwashed by the idiocy of the internet regarding psychology. Mm-hmm. And it's concerning. And now we're seeing clinicians, I don't know if this person is a victim of that. Sounds like they are, honestly. Because clinicians are just human beings, and they're going to go on TikTok. They're not going to prefer to go to a training. They're not going to prefer to go to supervision. They're going to like to spend time on TikTok. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to be influenced by the stupidity of... I mean, I've started making... I'm not going to say all TikToks are stupid, but...
You only have 45 seconds. I mean, come on.
But I have been reacting to TikTok videos on psychology lately mm-hmm. and putting them on YouTube. And it's astonishing the silliness on TikTok. It's particular. Like, YouTube has silliness, mm-hmm. but TikTok, the way the algorithm works and the way that the content producers are, it promotes or encourages or something the worst of the worst of the worst when it comes to... I just did a search by psychology, TikToks, mm-hmm. just anything related to psychology. I think 1 out of 100 had some viability to mm-hmm. it. Maybe I'm exaggerating a little bit, but a lot of it was just utter crap.
Well, and people have always used terms wrong.
Yeah.
Like, forever, 25 years ago, when I was at the beginning of my training, I was really struck how people use the term schizophrenic mm-hmm. wrong, like schizophrenic to mean confused, mm-hmm. or but not schizophrenic to mean command hallucinations that make me do socially unacceptable things.
Yeah.
So I remember...
But don't you feel like it's worse now, though?
Well, I have to say the way that people use the term gaslighting is very confusing to me.
Yeah.
Because
it took me a while to figure out what they were meaning by it.
Because absolutely. It seems to be gaslighting now means any behavior that I didn't like.
Right. That's true. And they're also referring to something that we can all kind of get behind, which is that, but we need a different word for it because it's not gaslighting. When you're having an argument with a partner, for example, and you remember them saying something yesterday, remember that fight we had yesterday, mm-hmm. and you said you wanted to get a divorce, and they're like, I never said that. Mm. They're calling that gaslighting. That's mm-hmm. not gaslighting. That's either motivated reasoning, it's lying, or they don't remember, or it's motivated remembering.
Or marriage.
Or it's marriage. You know, that's just par for the course that people will fight about. You said, no, I didn't say that. Yes.
Right.
And that's gaslighting. And then the other person, so if I were...
You're saying there's a level of intentional manipulation right. that's not present.
Right. It's but it's in the moment and it's very brief. But mm-hmm. gaslighting, we understand, is something, and we've had it in the clinical literature for decades. It's involved in an abusive relationship in which someone is consciously or unconsciously or somewhere in between, consistently over time, breaking down the victim's ability to judge reality such that they can become a more easily victimized victim. Mm-hmm. And it when you emerge out of that gaslighting, it takes 10, 20 years of work and therapy to re-believe in yourself that you are a good gauge of reality. If your partner is denying something that they said yesterday, it's not going to take you 10 years of therapy to mm-hmm. recover from that interaction. That's not gaslighting. So anyway, speed round.
Speed round.
St. Patrick's Day is today. This episode will air much later than St. Patrick's
Day. We're both wearing green, by the way.
I accidentally wore green, honestly.
Same here, but then I have my slightly green pants on, so then I put some socks that had green in it.
Yeah.
And so I'm plenty green.
Not that I'm against wearing green. No. I mean, I am slightly Irish. I'm like, I don't know,
I love a good holiday.
1/30th.
It's also Purim today, which rarely happens. It's St. Patrick's Day, and Purim fall on the same day.
Interesting. So you have a St. Patty's Day story.
Yeah. So when I was in San Francisco, which has a huge Irish population, when I was a kid, you used to go down to Union Square on St. Patrick's Day, and they would have like slots that had snakes in them, like gardener snakes. And you would be on a team, and every team would have a stick, and you would poke at the snake with the stick, and the person that got their snake to go out the other end, the first one.
Oh.
Now, I would love some San Franciscan historian to tell me when this practice ended, because this was clearly animal abuse.
Yeah.
And would never fly now.
Yeah, essentially it's torture snake race.
Yes, torture snake race for St. Patrick's Day. And every, you know, and I remember, like, we were little. We were, this is like first or second grade. We'd gone on the bus, go downtown and torture a snake mm-hmm. with in a team.
Yeah. And you gleefully did it, which makes you a psychopath.
I think I was a little, even I, at a young age, was concerned that there was this organized, like, you wouldn't do that with bunnies or guinea pigs.
Yeah. Well, there's not a lot of sympathy for snakes.
No. Yeah. And, you know, I grew up with the feminist ideology that this was really a metaphor for chasing the witches out of Ireland mm-hmm. or anyone different.
Right.
So, do you have a funny St. Patrick's Day story?
I don't, but my mom took all holidays very seriously, and even St. Patty's Day, I would get like a gift of some kind from my mom. And she gave me this one shirt one time that said something like, "Shut up about St. Patrick's Day, here's my green." And there was this little green dot. this like one green dot. It was a white shirt with a little green dot.
Yes.
I wore that shirt probably once a week uh-huh. for my entire high school career.
Yeah,
I love that shirt.
People
would always read that. It's like, what's going on? Anyway. Whoopi Goldberg, I wanted to talk with you about this.
Yeah.
Since you're a fan of Whoopi, mm-hmm. and this also involved talking about Jewish people. Mm-hmm. So if you didn't know, back in January 2022 on The View, her TV show that she's on, she kind of went on a little rant about the Holocaust during World War II was not based on race, she was saying. The Holocaust was not about race. It was about man's inhumanity to man. She says, "This is white people doing it to white people. So y'all are going to fight amongst yourselves. These are two white groups of people essentially saying it can't be about race since mm-hmm. it's two groups of white people. When we talk," she says, "when we talk about race, it's a different thing to me because as a black person, I think of race as something that I can see." What do you think about that, Rebecca?
So I just, all props to Whoopi, and it's hard for me to do a Whoopi speed round because I could go off for half an hour about how much she means to me and how her work in the theater and her work with comedy, her work as an actress has influenced me. Speed round, we'll stop there. But, I mean, what she is technically saying, and Jews, progressive Jews talk about this a lot, that we are now considered white, but we weren't always considered white. And so this idea that you could look at me and see me as a white person the same way that Europeans have hierarchy, even though they're all, quote, white, people in Spain are on the bottom. People in Romania are on the bottom. People who are in Sweden are on the top. So there is colorism in that whiteness. But at the time of the Holocaust, Jews were not considered Caucasian. Jews were considered extremely different. That being said, Jews were not the only people killed in the Holocaust. So Romani, or what's used to be known as Gypsies, Catholics, mm-hmm. political prisoners, gays, lesbians, prostitutes,
disabled people?
I'm sure disabled people.
Yeah.
In fact, if you watch Man in the High Castle,
I have. I've seen a couple episodes.
In the first episode, they talk about killing disabled people as part of how the Third Reich appears in the United States.
You know, our colleague was on that show.
Oh, really?
Yeah, McCall, our a professor at Antioch. She's an actress, and she was on that show.
Yeah, it's shot here in Seattle.
Yeah. Oh, it was?
Yeah.
Oh, I guess that, it's an Amazon show, right? So maybe that's why?
Maybe.
Yeah, I don't know.
Anyways, so the Holocaust is far extending beyond, quote, race. And, you know, here we are 90 years later before the start. I mean, the Third Reich was, you know, ramping up this
early 30s.
This time 90 years ago.
Yeah.
And if you speak to the part of my extended family that has been through the Holocaust, you know, 1938 is a line for them. So in America, we think about, oh, we joined the war in
42.
But, you know, the Holocaust was way on its way progressed.
Yeah.
At that point.
Right.
So is Whoopi technically correct? No. Am I personally mad at her for what she said? Also, no.
Okay. Do you understand how other Jewish people would consider it hurtful?
Yes.
Why would they consider it hurtful?
Because there is a section of Jews that anybody has, the only people who can talk about the Holocaust are other Jews. And any comment that doesn't put the Holocaust front and center, and Jewish suffering, particularly in the Holocaust, front and center, are bad.
Yeah.
Like, it can get very intense as a defining factor.
Which makes sense. I mean, after decades and still people denying that it happened when you and your relatives literally lived through it, it can feel a little wearisome over time, where you're just like, okay, unless you're a Jewish person who really gets it, you don't have the right to scrutinize what's happening here, because I've had enough of decade after decade of people scrutinizing this. And so shut up, y'all. So, you know, I get that. But what do you think Whoopi meant by saying it was not about racism? It was just about white people doing it to white people. What do you think she was trying to get at? What was
her
point?
Do you hear me sighing into the mic? I mean, it is so complicated. So why did Hitler really go after the Polish Jews who look just like me?
I mean, the historians will say it was to whip up a frenzy to gain political power so that he could rise in power.
But they also had light eyes and light hair like I do and didn't meet his description of a Jew.
Well, and the fact that Jewish people were targeted was because of centuries-old ideas about Jewish people in Europe as being the enemy, and it just was a convenient scapegoat for him to attack. And or he legitimately hated Jewish people and or himself. But anyway, why? What do you
Why did Whoopi say this? I think Whoopi said this because we don't really address racism in our society, and she, as a black woman raising a black family, the primary, I'm sure she's financially supporting a large section of her family. She has a lot of frustrations with how white people are and how white people don't understand the plague of racism. So was slavery killed 10 times the amount of Jews that the Holocaust killed? I think, you know, it was obviously over a longer period of time. But is she saying white people have been worse to people of color than they have to Jews? I'm not quite sure. But definitely what she's saying is, to me, what she's saying is I don't even know how to say it. The Holocaust, in the Holocaust, people that to her basically look exactly alike killed each other.
Yeah. I don't know. And I've thought about this a lot. I've read her apologies and heard other commentators, other podcasts with black hosts will talk about what she did. And I haven't heard anyone say this, so I'm thinking maybe I'm off base, but what do you think? I think what she was getting at was that racism against black people in the United States is horrible and deeply ingrained in our culture and is still going on. And I feel like kind of what you're getting at, people don't take it seriously. And that when people talk about the racism happening during the Holocaust as some sort of, well, you know, racism happened. I'm guessing she was arguing with someone that wasn't on the TV show that she had a previous interaction with of some kind, that they were saying something like to her, she was talking about, or she heard someone else advocating for awareness of racism against black people. And someone was saying, well, you know, racism happens all over the world. That, you know, the Jewish people were, you know, it just happens. It's just normal part of human life or whatever. Somehow the message was the data point of the Holocaust was brought up as a overall messaging around it's not a big deal or it's not as bad or something along those lines.
Or you have to demarcate people. I mean, there's a reason that Jews wore a yellow Star of David on their clothing at all times during the Holocaust to demarcate themselves as other. And there's a reason that numbers were tattooed on their arms in the camp to say this person is other. If this person ever had a chance as passing as a non-Jew, here is evidence that they are a Jew. And Jews were able to hide. I mean, it would say Jewish on your passport, right? So people hid papers, got fake papers, and people were able to hide. And in America, a black person cannot hide.
Right. And that's the other point that she's getting is that, and she even brought that up in her apologies, is that for, you know, Jewish people can, in the United States anyway, and I guess outside of being branded, can blend in if they want to. They could act Catholic or Protestant or something else and or act English or whatever it is. And not that there aren't English Jewish, you know what I'm saying, you know,
right,
to act like whatever it is considered to be the acceptable white people. And black people can never do that and will never be able to do that. And I think that's what she was trying to get at, but it just came out in this like extremely inappropriate, I'm going to say anti-Semitic way. Like there's a lot of ways she could have said that, mm-hmm. right? There's a lot of ways she could say like, look, I don't think y'all take black racism seriously. You know, like da 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 da. And what happened to the Jewish people in Europe during the Holocaust is also awful, but at least those people, generation later, could blend in the mm-hmm. United States. Not that anti-Semitism doesn't exist in the United States. The other thing is you know, there's a fair amount of anti-Semitism amongst people of color in the United States, including Asian Americans. So that there's an old tradition of that and how it is allowed, so to speak, because, or people feel like they have license to be anti-Semitic because they are a person of color, not just specifically anti-Semitic, but the permission that some people feel like they have because they're not white and it gives them the quote unquote privilege to be racist or othering towards other kinds of people. And so I feel like she stepped in that, mm-hmm. You know, pile of doo-doo and she apologized. And I don't think Whoopi Goldberg is a general anti-Semitic individual. I don't think that, but when I heard the rant, I'm like, what is she talking about? Of course it's about race. Mm-hmm. What did you think it was about? It was about race. Mm-hmm. Literally, Hitler said the German word for race. It was a racial war. It was a racial genocide. Like, what are you talking about? And yes, it is about, I guess, according to Americans' version of white people, attacking white people. But yeah, anyway. So
Speed round.
Let's take a break and more speed round.
Okay.
So, Rebecca, you watched the Anna Delvey show.
Loved it.
I haven't watched. I saw a little bit of it.
Gotta watch it. I'll watch it. I'll rewatch it with you.
I did a deep dive about her, me and Umberto, a couple years ago when the story came out.
And I listened to it to prepare to talk to you today.
Okay. I don't remember it that well. But what can you tell us about the TV show?
Well, I would highly recommend watching it, especially if you have any thoughts about truth and lying and identity. It's really interesting. First off, she never feels that she's done anything wrong. So there's a lot of pathology going on there. But she still inspires a tremendous amount of empathy from the people around her. Mm. And it gets to a point in the show where each episode follows a major secondary character and you see her through their eyes. And so that's really interesting.
So in case people don't know, Anna Delvey was a con artist from, I believe, Eastern Europe, but claimed to be from somewhere else.
She was from Russia, moved to Germany at 15, but only claimed that she was German,
and conned her way into the ritzy life of rich people in super nice hotels that cost $10,000 a month, or I don't know, some astronomical price, and she's a young pretty girl, young petite woman, and would kind of use that to her advantage, and she was hanging out with very rich people, but just a classic psychopath from what I could tell, from the, you know, similar to the Tinder swindler kind of person, maybe not as bad, but
also love that one,
but definitely of that ilk where they just can't help themselves. You're just looking at, you look at that person's story and you're like, well, obviously you have talent and charisma. Why did you use it to just blaze a trail of destruction that will eventually catch? Because she was in debt, like hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then eventually it and the thing about the Tinder swindler is he's only criminally responsible for a little bit of what he did, because a lot of what he did was just ask people to give him money. Mm-hmm. And he lied to them about being their boyfriend, but that's not a crime. It's fraudulent. It's kind of interesting if you fraud a human being, that's not against the law. But
fraud
if
you, a business.
But if you fraud a bank, then all bets are off. That's right. Like a high Interpol international crime that you can go to jail for years over, I find that to be highly suspicious,
Well, and it's actually, she uses that to her advantage. So in the show, every episode begins with everything in the show is true except for the stuff that we made up. So you don't know what's made up. But one of the interesting angles that they take is that she defrauded this woman of $200,000 and the woman doesn't report her. Because the woman wants to keep her status. And this is an affluent woman, in her early 60s, who surrounds herself with beautiful young people and has Anna run errands for her. And when she gives Anna the credit card to pay for something, Anna buys an extra $10,000 worth of stuff every time. And then it adds up and comes back to the woman. But the woman won't report her because she doesn't want anyone to know that she's been swindled, which I thought was really interesting, that there's this whole status piece.
Like, because it makes her look like, one, stupid, and two, that she cares about money or something. Because if you're super rich, you don't care. Okay, yeah, she took $200,000. I don't care. Who cares, right? That kind of thing.
Yeah.
So how many Rebeccas out of 10 would you give this TV show?
An 8, okay. Easily. Right. It's a good, easy watch, and the music's really good, and it's Shonda Rhimes, who I've never really gotten into before, and I can see the formula.
I would hear Stacey watching the show, and I remember thinking, like, wow, that's a good pull, that musical, and they would really let the song breathe on the show, it seemed. Did it glorify Anna Delvey's con artistry?
I don't think so. It really showed the emotional impact of everyone that she swindled and how it impacted their lives and their inability to trust.
Does it make her look cool?
No. She's in jail, a good portion of it. Okay. And she is continuing to push away people while she's in jail.
Okay.
But she's also hustling while she's in jail to get by. I mean, you can see this is a survivor.
Yeah. Yeah, and as a lot of con artistry emerges from, it doesn't justify it by any means, but of the and the injection of classism and materialism, because the Tinder swindler Anna Delvey, if they were really interested in survival, they would have squirreled away $5,000 in a bank account, or bought stocks, or bought a house that has value. But it was never that. It was always like super extravagance and just wasting money on clubs and, you know, overpriced hotels. I mean, that's the thing about me. Like a mid-level hotel, the different, you know, that's like what, $500 a night, mm-hmm. kind of a thing. An expensive hotel, $5,000. What is the difference?
It's a living room.
It's a bed. it's a toilet. It's a shower. It's a maybe the concierge is a little bit more chipper mm-hmm. when you talk to him, but you know, a mid-level hotel, they're helpful enough, right? I just find that whereas the difference between an apartment that you rent for $500 mm-hmm. as opposed to there's a difference. There's a difference in that. But I found hotels, I'm like, well, what do you get beyond that point? I mean, do they just like,
well, you get
massage
the name.
Your feet every night or something?
I think you get the name of where you're staying yeah. and all the other people are there. And I was wondering, have you ever lived in New York?
No. Lived okay. in New York?
Yeah.
I've never lived outside Seattle. You
okay.
know that.
Okay. So I didn't actually know that you've never lived outside Seattle. Uh-uh. So I've lived in New York, and this was very reminiscent. When you live in New York and your friends are doing this and that, every once in a while you're a plus one to an outrageous event that you should really not be at. And you watch this culture that Anna Delvey is in, and how important status is to each other. And then when even the fancier person arrives and the whole room turns to see, oh my God, they're there. So if you think of like tiny Met galas happening all over town all the time.
So gross. It's like, and I've had snippets of that where people will be like, because it's all about, especially now with selfies and whatnot, that the next day they can say, maybe even on Instagram, oh my God, I was at a party and so-and-so showed up. And it's just like, who cares? Like, that's a human being. Did they somehow enhance your life because they walked in the room? Like, shut up. I don't know. It's just like, stop it, people. Like, there's more meaningful things in life, like the fact that we're polluting our planet and everything's going down the toilet. Anyway.
Speed round.
Respond. Anonymous patron said, for years now, I have been subject to aggression from strangers in public. How should I respond to prejudice in public? Mm. Rebecca.
Well, there's a couple ways to go. I mean, you can respond back if you feel safe enough to do so. I mean, that's how many of the terms that are seen as slurs get used back. So if someone yelled at me, you're so queer, I might, if I felt safe enough, would yell back, yes, you are perceptive. You know, people do shy away from those situations, and I have too. Like, you just put your head down and keep going and know that that's that person's crap and not yours. You know, there have been times in my life where I have changed the way that I have dressed or presented to get less attention. I hated that I had to do that. But I remember actually showing my friends an example, because I always wear my hair up. And someone asked me, why do you do that? And we were downtown, and I was like, okay, watch the difference. And I put my hair down, and I got treated completely differently by men in terms of comments and looks. And so, you know, it just depends on what you have the energy for. It's exhausting, and it's why, for gay people, especially in my youth, it was why we hung out in big groups, so that we weren't alone in those kinds of attacks.
Yeah, I don't know what, I mean, I think about the times where I've been in public and I've been called some kind of Asian slur, and I'm trying to think of a time when I responded in a way that felt satisfying to me. And I think the one time I can think of that I responded in a way that I at least don't regret was, I just didn't say anything. I just looked at him like, huh? And it's like, did that just come out of your face? And but that doesn't feel satisfying to me. It's not like I got them back, right? And I'm just trying to think what you could say back that would be satisfying, you know, like racist or like, I don't know what you could say, you know, like, yeah, thanks for that. Like, well, you must be a genius, or go back to the 1950s, or I don't know, like, I'm just trying to think what you could say that would be a zinger or that would get the other person to think. Like, people will email in questions like this, and the general policy or foundation I have is when the other person creates a problem, you can't roll that back.
Yeah,
there's nothing
keep yourself.
You can do to recover the situation because they've created a massive problem that the two of you are just not going to dig yourself out of no matter what you say.
Right. I mean, I always think, like, keep yourself safe.
Yeah.
Which is sad.
Yeah.
Speed round.
Anonymous patron from New York says, speaking of, how can I move on from racist comments? I am a third culture kid who lives here in the United States. Although I'm originally from Asia, I speak American English as my native language with no accent. I get incredibly frustrated when strangers ask me where I'm from, make assumptions about who I am, or straight up tell me what ethnicity they think I should be, when it's clearly because of the way I look and not because that they want to get to know me. These comments mostly come from new immigrants from my parents' culture, where it's not considered as inappropriate to ask about very touchy personal matters such as body weight and relationship status. And I can't help but feel resentment towards my parents' culture. Mm-hmm. Working on it in therapy hasn't helped me much at all. Do you have any pointers you can give? I don't think it's healthy to have a breakdown every time I get a comment like this. Rebecca, what do you think? Similar to the last one, really, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, this is why people join groups that reflect themselves. So, like, this is why I both need and battle with being in Jewish groups so that I can see myself reflected and tell these kinds of stories. But also my internalized anti-Semitism comes up, and I hate the behavior of people in my own culture as well. I mean, there are definitely demarcations like that, what we were just saying earlier about the Holocaust, like when Jews go off about the Holocaust being the worst thing that ever happened and how their pain trumps everybody else's pain, I am flooded with shame every single time. But the way I work on that is hanging out with other Jews that have similar thoughts that I have and talking about my modern experience of Judaism in this time. So I would just say try and find other folks from your community. And this sounds very familiar to me for a client that I have who's Chinese American, and the struggles that she has with the traditional Chinese values of her parents and her American values now. And I would just say there's tons of literature out there and huge Instagram presence of people in a similar battle. Because you're code switching, you're walking between two cultures. So I would suggest, you know, find a community in it.
Yeah. The only thing I'll add to that is that just because something is from your parents' culture and it's from the home country, if you will, doesn't mean that it's not a problem. And there's a huge problem in some East Asian cultures of shaming people for their bodies, for their careers, for their relationship status. And it's not okay. So what do you do? Again, once they throw it out there, it's hard to make it right, so to speak. But you do have the right at least to consider saying something to your parents, friends, and aunts and uncles, to say something like, hey, you know, when you say that, when you ask me that question, it really puts me in a weird position. And I know you don't mean anything by it, but it makes me feel like crap. And I know you don't want to make me feel like crap, but, and maybe this is the American in me or something, but I just don't like it when you comment on the fact that I've gained a little weight. I already have a complex enough as it is. And I'm sure you don't mean it that way, but it hurts. Or, you know, the fact that you sort of ask me that question every time I see you, you know, when am I going to have kids? It sort of implies to me that you don't feel like I'm a worthy human being without kids. I know you don't mean it that way, but And again, maybe this is the American in me, and I'm sorry that I'm saying this, but I just wish, and I don't want to be disrespectful to you. I love you, and I you know, I respect you, but I just want you to know, like, it doesn't make me feel good. And I've had this conversation with a lot of Asian American clients, first, second, third generation, and you know, it's nuanced, because sometimes you're just like, well, it is what it is. You know, that's another thing that you can kind of do is say, well, you know, they're from the old country and that's how they think, and that's what they all do this, and I'm not going to take it personally. And but to have a lifetime of being shamed every time, I mean, there are people that I know, Chinese people, Korean people, who literally every time they run into a certain uncle, he comments on the fact that they're fat or something like that. And it's just like, my effing God, like, just anything else you could say about me, like, why just not? And it's totally normal just in the middle of Thanksgiving for mm-hmm. uncle to be like, well, you look like you've gained weight. Like, and it is kind of different. It's not the same as in the United States. It's not as sensitive. One, it's not as sensitive a topic in general. It's not like someone from that region can't be sensitive, but it also is considered totally normal to sure. just call people out in the middle of a family.
Your body is everybody's body, right? Yeah. Your presentation belongs to the whole group. It's yeah. not just yours.
Yeah, but that notion, even though is common, I don't consider it to be very helpful, even if you're embedded in that culture. Some difference of that element, I think, is fine, but how far it goes is, you know, it's just not a great aim.
Well, and it says more about that other person than it does about you, yeah. that they can't have any other ways of thinking. And only while you were talking, I was thinking, you know, and is there some early trauma about how having this difference really impacted you, and have you done enough work on that?
People out there, before commenting on someone else's body, think about the following premise. They already know, you idiot. Do you think it's possible that someone can gain even 2 pounds in American society and not notice it? Do you think it's possible that an American can, you know, change their pant size and not take note of the fact that they're bigger now? Like, you don't have to point it out. They already know. So shut up. Anonymous patron says,
speed round.
I've been worrying lately since my boyfriend and I sometimes talk about having kids. He's Jamaican, but my mom is racist in a passive way that a lot of white people are in the way that a lot of white people in their 50s are racist.
That's us. That's me.
I could easily see her calling a child we have mulatto or joking in a Jamaican accent to bond. Mm-hmm. I've had many discussions with her about racism, and it's like talking to a brick wall, because she maintains that it's not racist to recognize differences in people, which isn't all of what's actually happening in my eyes. I think I may just have to cut her off completely. Mm-hmm. Should it come to this? In your opinion, what would be the lesser of two evils? Obviously, I love her, but I already am a mom, and the idea of letting anyone just hurt my child is unfathomable. Rebecca, what do you think?
Yeah, this is, excuse me, this is a real issue, that if she's unable to see this child as fully human for any reason, it's really difficult to hang out. And, you know, you choose your child first over your parent. That's how we're genetically programmed to do. If she doesn't make you feel safe consistently and can't learn new behaviors, the kid is going to feel it. I mean, I've heard stories of this all the time, of people who have a child who really presents as darker skin than maybe other children that they've had, and that the grandparents can't let go. Yeah. Even George W. Bush.
The royal family.
Where the royal family is a great example. And was it George W. or just George Bush, where they had the brown grandchild that he called on national TV the brown grandchild?
God.
So, yeah, we have a huge problem with this, with race and colorism in our society. And I can understand your fears. The idea that your parent would be condescending and racist to your child. That's very, very difficult.
Yeah.
And you may have to cut her off. Yeah.
Especially if you've talked about it before. And I think that you're completely in the right, in my opinion, based on what you're saying, to consider cutting them off or limiting contact because you've tried to talk with her about it. Having said that, unless your mom is a psychopath, there's an avenue toward understanding and change, which often involves longer conversations. You know, you mentioned that she's the sort of person who will say something like, "Oh, where are you from?" And you've pushed back on that and said, you know, it's not very helpful. My guess is, I don't know, that you weren't very in depth in terms of why you shouldn't say something like that, which is the norm. You know, in fact, online, when particularly around Asians, because I'll watch that kind of content, someone will just be like, you know, "Where are you from?" And then someone will say, "You're not supposed to ask that." And they just don't really follow it up with why. And that's why I'm always pretty long-winded when it comes to this sort of thing, because once you understand why yourself as the aggrieved, you can explain why to the perpetrator. So when you go to your mom, you can say, "So it's fine to be curious about someone's background. There's nothing racist about that. It's fine to want to know and to want to celebrate that. There's nothing racist about that. But just imagine you're walking around in America, in the United States, and there's something about you that makes you non-mainstream. You are not white, Protestant, male, da-da-da. And frequently, say, one out of 20 white people walk up to you, not many, but 5%, walk up to you and say, 'Where are you from?' After the 1,000th time, it's going to be aggravating. It's going to be a reminder, and you match that up with the fact that you're, say, 25% of the time, in a very noticeable way, treated unfairly. You're being treated as lesser or scary or something. And this question of where are you from reminds you of the fact that behind all of those smiles and how are yous that white people are doing is, in all likelihood, a recognition that I don't belong and that I'm different and that I'm lesser or something. You know, there's something different about me that is immediately recognizable to other people that provokes this question, where are you from? So when you ask, where are you from, you're not coming from a horrible place for sure, but it reminds them of all of that. And so just don't ask those kinds of questions.
Right. And it's, you're reeking in your privilege that you're assuming that I'm from here. You must be from somewhere else if you don't look like me. Right. So I want to recommend one resource that I've really been enjoying. It's Blair Imani on Instagram. She's known for this thing called Smarter in Seconds, where she takes really tough topics and breaks it down. Mm. And she has a new one came out a couple of days ago called 6 Tips for Tough Conversations. And the first one I thought was really interesting was, just remember, you're just here to state your opinion. You can't really convince anybody of anything. And that this comes up so much in conversations about intergenerational conversations addressing race or class, where the older generation just can't shift.
Yeah.
They can't pivot quickly.
Yeah.
And this idea for us as younger people to remember, like, we're just stating our opinion. We're not going to change their minds. And that's something that you have to sit with.
Yeah. And I've had all sorts of reactions. 95% of the time, I will just blurt something out that is mean, you know, because I'm, as you know, podcast listeners out there, I'm not opinionated, and I'm not confident in my opinions. So when an older person says something that's homophobic or transphobic or something, I'm just thinking about something I went through not long ago. I just blurt out like something like, "What did you just say?" What, you know, and I'll just attack. I just go on this because I feel I'm angry, mm-hmm. and I feel hurt for those people who are being hurt. And I guess by extension, my own victimhood and on various identities. But it doesn't come out well. I will say that there are times when that happens when I walk away and go like, well, that wasn't the best, but I don't know, the person deserved it. Like, and they're talking to me. Like, mm-hmm. I oftentimes think about that. I'm like, my people know who I am and what I stand for, mm-hmm. and what where I work and all that kind of stuff. And so I'm like, you not only said that, you not only thought that, but you said it in front of me, mm-hmm. and you know what I stand for. Mm-hmm. And so you stepped on that landmine yourself. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going to get an explosion, then that's just what you're going to get, because yeah. you said it to me and you should have known better.
I want to speed round here, but I also feel, I just was thinking recently about a friendship that ended, I think before the pandemic. Someone from high school, which for me is like a class divide, generation divide, even though we grew up at the same time, it's where I went to high school. It was like the 1950s. And this person said...
You went to high school with Tucker Carlson, right?
I went to middle school with Tucker Carlson. Yeah. Yeah. To give everyone a sense of what I'm talking about. and so... our friendship ended about me advocating, just sharing a story of a trans masculine friend I had. They were in the ER. They did not get read correctly for their gender and how they needed to pee. And it was like a complete disaster. And so I just wrote this kind of, I felt like kind of simple, joyful advocating post. Like, look, hey, people, you may not know what trans masculine means. If you come across that person and they need to pee in the emergency room, here's what they need. And this person that I had reconnected from high school with Chuck
Meaning
Carlson,
just point at the bathrooms. Don't point at a particular bathroom.
Right? Well, not even that. Don't hand them a certain device that men, that people with penises can use to urinate in. But if you don't have that part, you can't
right.
conveniently use this item.
Oh, okay.
Which Lady Bunny just joked about using as a gravy boat, which was very funny. And this person just went off about advocating for the people in the ER and how should they possibly know what transmasculine meant. And I feel like
they should be the first people that would know, because it's...
Well, especially here in Seattle. Yeah. Maybe in other parts of the country, it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
But here's...
Like expecting your... You know, your accountant to understand is a lot, but a medical professional, it should be one of those things that you just learn about.
Yeah. So the comment to me was so inflammatory, knowing who I am and who my friends are on Facebook. I took the comment off and wrote this person. We'll just call him Tucker Carlson. I wrote Tucker Carlson back channels and said, hey, just so you know, like, this is what I did. And he completely flamed me about I don't allow free speech on my page. And I had conversations with friends over the next couple
Wait,
days.
This is your personal wall?
Yeah.
This is your personal Facebook page?
Yeah.
And he's screaming free speech on your personal Facebook page?
Yeah.
Wow.
And
not a huge loss at that point.
Yeah. And so our friendship ended. So anyways, I was talking to a friend about this, and she said, does he know who you are and what you do for a living? And
right, that's the whole thing. Like, who do you think I am? You know, you're just going to say that in front of me? Like, what did you think I was going to say to that?
Or that also, I feel like my role is to protect my friends, many of whom are trans,
yeah,
from seeing that kind of bullshit on my page.
Well, deleting a comment that's transphobic on your own personal page is completely justified. Like,
speed round.
The way that, okay, just a minor discord on the speed round. The way that people react, people feel, even on my page, like my YouTube channel or something, mm-hmm. very rare. Literally once a year, I'll have to delete something mm-hmm. because someone's just, you know, oftentimes people will contact us mm-hmm. and say, like, there's someone on the blank page saying blank that you got to deal with. And so we'll try to deal with it. And every once in a while, we just delete the whole thing. We're just mm-hmm. like, this person is, like, not making sense, or they're obviously not here on good faith. And so let's get rid of them. And the way that they react, it's always like they – people feel entitled. It's like, if you want to have your own website,
sure.
If you want to comment on your own Facebook page, mm-hmm. if you want to create your own YouTube channel or have your own podcast, blah, 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 then go for it. But your rights, you don't have the right to comment and have it be a megaphone for your ridiculousness on my page. You know what I mean? And people get real righteous about it. I'm just like, shut up, people. Anyway. But now, having said all that, with the people, the example I'm thinking about in my head where I exploded, I did later on, I don't know how much longer, but I did sit them down and actually had a long conversation mm-hmm. and actually did explain to them what was, not necessarily that previous, but like what we were dealing with at the time. And it did change their mind because I took the time to, and I gave them the benefit of the doubt, and I even sympathize. Like, I get it. When I first heard about X, Y, and Z, I had the same thoughts you did. It just sounded weird to me. But the more I looked into it, here's the reality of it. You know, it's just, you know, you help people. Anyway, patron Thula from Norway says, or Tula, I don't know, Tula or Thula. How do I stop comparing myself to other women and people in general? Mm-hmm. Why is it that I, as a 23-year-old female, mm-hmm. always feel so inferior to mm-hmm. other females? I'm conventionally pretty. Mm-hmm. I have a good job as a journalist, and I have a boyfriend who says he loves me. Mm-hmm. Still, every other person's success feels like it makes me inferior to them. Mm-hmm. I know where it all stems from, but how do I change my mindset? Mm-hmm. Rebecca, what do you think?
Ooh, low self-esteem. Let me start over. Thula, your low self-esteem is incredibly familiar to me. As women, we are, as femme-bodied people, we are trained from an early age to compare ourselves and feel less than others. Here are some ways that I deal with that. So one, when I'm working with clients, I talk a lot. So there's this great book called The Buddha Brain. Have we talked about it? So it talks about the neuroscience of landing on the negative, that this is actually some kind of evolutionary aspect of our brain to see the worst. And we have to train our brains to the other side.
Is the idea that we, it serves, we evolved to do that because it served an evolutionary advantage because if something horrible happens socially or physically or, you know, environmentally, we best pay attention to that to avoid it happening in the future. Whereas if a good thing happens, then we don't, you know, it's good reinforcement and we can kind of remember it. But the bad incidents, like a saber-toothed tiger eating our cousin, are events that we really should not, you know, pass over memory-wise.
Yes. Yeah. But in our modern world, because we are bombarded with so much information constantly, to land on the negative. So if you think about Instagram, and, you know, I'm just scrolling through, and everybody who is 10 pounds lighter than me, you know, I hate, I'm going to have a pretty bad day. So I got to get off Instagram, or I got to fill my feed with people who are body positive, or I got to take a media Sabbath and just really take a break. And I recommend everybody really take a break from it. And then there's also building yourself from the inside out and realizing what are kind of societal constructs that have told you to look for your flaws and look for the ways that you're less than. And then what is the, this is what bell hooks talked about, the radical act of self-love, to love yourself for what you have. It sounds like you have an amazing life. And can you, like the Buddha Brain says, lean towards the positive whenever you can? And it's a practice. That's why they call meditation the practice. But it takes work. So when I am having a really bad day or somebody tells me I'm not good at my job, I laughingly joke to myself, I am a monthly guest on Kirk Honda's podcast. You can't even touch that. Good luck with that. So, you know, there are some... So that's thought replacement. That's classic cognitive behavioral thought replacement. Yeah. I have a bad thought and I try and teach myself to put in a good thought. Because there's a lot of ways that society would tear me down and has torn me down. I mean, my dyslexia is another example where people said to me over and over again, you'll never succeed at anything because you can't write a grammatically correct sentence and stay in a tense that is the same all the way through the sentence. But, you know, they couldn't imagine this world that I've created for myself where I get paid pretty well to talk for a living. Mm-hmm. And I barely have to write anything down.
So it's what you're focusing on and have throughout the years to get to where you're at. Yeah, that's really beautiful. The only thing I'll add to that or expand on what you're saying is radical self-love, which I also think holds with it a bit of anger, which is, screw you guys, I'm going home and I'm going to love myself. You know, like the courage it takes sometimes to reject society. And I will do this sometimes, including this episode, of just getting really angry about something. Women in general are socialized to not be angry. And that, you know, that might be part of it. I'll just speak for myself that there are times when, you know, because everyone, regardless of gender, there are ample opportunities to internalize messages to self-shame. And when I'm at my best, I am angry about it. I'm just like, screw that noise. You know, that's stupid. Society is stupid in that way. Society can be glorious in some ways, but society is stupid in that way, and I do not regard it. It doesn't get rid of it inside of my head or my body, but it's something. It's appropriate and it helps me to, it focuses me and it, I reject it. I'm just like, because I feel like one of the common coping mechanism is, well, you just got to love yourself. And that's great, of course, if you can. But if you have this constant voice in your head that's been internalized, it's like, you're a piece of crap, you're a piece of crap, you're a piece of crap. At some point, you got to look at that voice and say, shut the F up. No. You know, you are stupid. Your whole premise is like flawed. I argue against you. I reject you. I denounce you. You're not right. You know, anything that comes out of you, voice, is just ridiculous. So stop it. You know, I feel like there's an empowerment to that.
And so here's an art challenge. You've been getting some great fan art lately.
Yeah. You've been seeing that on Instagram.
I love it.
Yeah. So people are capturing my face pretty well, actually. Yeah.
So an art therapy directive I have people do is to draw the inner critic so we can get to know it and personify it and be more likely to shut it down. And so I would challenge people to draw their inner critics and send us those images. We'd love to see them. Hmm. But once you draw that inner critic and externalize it and can look at it and make fun of it and realize it's not all that powerful, You can shut it off. You can replace it with another voice.
Yeah, if you want to, whatever art you're doing, take a picture, Instagram it, and tag our text, which is Rebecca's Instagram. I'm guessing she would really like that. So it's just the letter R and text.
Yes.
How did you come up with that Instagram?
So long ago, I dreamed of being a DJ. And I thought it was funny. So it's T-Rex, but turned around, our text. But it's also our, like, our text, our words.
Oh.
And then also, you know, my first name begins with an R.
Right.
But it was really a DJ name that I never got to use. It was going to be DJ Our Text. And then Instagram came out, and I thought, oh, this is a chance for me to use that DJ name. And it's just, I like it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's easy to recognize. So, yeah, Rebecca is active on Instagram with her own art, and so I'm sure she'd love to see your art. All right, Rebecca, that was pretty good. In an hour, I felt like we only got 20% through the document, but that's okay.
Everyone, I love that there is a document.
Yeah.
And just so everyone knows, like, I don't see these things.
Yeah.
These documents are hidden from me.
Yeah.
And they exist only in Kirk's cyberspace.
There's a Rebecca document. And everyone out there, have your own documents if you want. And take care of yourself because...
because your inner critic isn't right. So go ahead and shut that sucker up.